Remember that song and the dance that was tied into it? Do the Freddy? Wow, have things changed, huh? Well, in a moment, Neil Slade joins us for the hour. We'll take calls a little bit later on this hour as well as we talk about his work in the Dormant Brain Lab. What's that mean? You'll find out in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Neil Slade, author of 10 books plus on brain and behavior, including, of course, one of our favorites, Tickle Your Amygdala, The Frontal Lobe Supercharged, and so many more. A lifelong musical composer, seasoned concert performer, and teacher. His educational books are easy to understand, explorations of how the human brain works and how to access creativity and problem solving. Neil has been a teacher since 1972, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hello, Mr. Slade.
Hi, George. It's been a while. Great to speak with you again.
You too. You too. People talk a lot about consciousness. Mm-hmm. Is the brain tied to that, or does consciousness exist outside of the brain?
Nobody knows for sure, but I'll give you my personal opinion. Consciousness resides within the human brain, and it also resides outside of the human brain. I say that because of the scientific evidence and the anecdotal evidence of people who experience consciousness when they've died on the operating table and come back to talk about, being conscious outside of their dead body for that time.
Neil, how did you get interested in brain power and brain research?
I got my degree in music education.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always interested in creativity and what the creative process was. And that led me to become involved with a fellow by the name of T.D. Lingo, and a place that he ran in the Colorado wilderness called the Dormant Brain Lab. And I just saw a documentary of him, which you can also actually view on YouTube now, because I posted that documentary. And I watched the documentary about his work in the brain lab, and I wrote him a letter, and within a very short period of time, I became involved in first going to the lab as a student, and then I was his assistant for 11 years following that, and continued his work after his own death in 1993.
Did you see some astonishing things?
Oh, just too many to count. I mean, everything. My experiences, and I directly relate this to learning certain brain basics and learning how to do what Lingo called brain self-control and what we have talked about on your show as tickling the amygdala. Once you learn where these magic places are in your own brain, it's like the fire hose opens up and psychic events become routine, ESP becomes routine, precognition, even telekinesis. We've talked about the flying broom on your show. So we've physical objects moving with no explanation, all kinds of things, just the whole gamut. I've seen and experienced as a result of, learning these certain brain things that we're going to talk about.
Neil, could a injury to the brain magnify the brain's ability to do certain things?
Oh, yeah. There's lots of stories. I think there's a well-known story of a doctor, and I've probably heard you talking about this with other people on your show.
Yeah.
A doctor who had a brain injury, and then suddenly he found he could compose music.
Or speak in a different language.
Yes. I mean, we don't know. We're just delving into learning about the human brain. And even when Lingo began his work in 1957, very little was known about the human brain. And in the past 50 years, so much has been learned, but it's still just the tip of the iceberg. So when the brain changes, either through voluntary self-control processes or by accident and manipulation or even surgeries, all kinds of things can happen. And, we know that brain injury can result in the loss of function. But what's fascinating is the change and increase of functions that were hitherto dormant before the injury or the accident or the surgery.
Let's talk about the power of the brain and its ability to do telepathy and be psychic and just do all these incredible things. How do people tune themselves to do things like that?
Well, you know, the books that I've written and the techniques that Lingo had written about, Lingo first began exploring how you open up these areas of the brain that he would call dormant. And
that's what he called the dormant brain lab, right?
Yeah. And that's why it was called the dormant brain lab, because at that time, the folk saying was that people only use 10% of your brain. And there's always been contention to that statement, and often by scientists. And it's misunderstood. What does it mean that the human brain is dormant, that you only use 10% of your brain? Now, very often we hear scientists say, and medical people say, well, you use all of your brain all of the time. So it's only a myth. It's just a myth that you only use 10% of your brain. But it's really how you look at it. It's really how you look at it. We don't know how much of our brain that we use. And the reason we can say something like that there is untapped resources within the human brain, one very critical thing to look at is brain scans. You can look at positive emission tomography. You can look at functional MRI. And you can see that brain function changes from moment to moment, that you have areas of the brain that at one moment will be very active, and then in the next moment will not be active at all or will be relatively inactive. If you didn't have a modulation of brain activity throughout the brain, brain scans wouldn't work at all. There would be no point. If you used all of your brain all of the time, which I hear scientists say erroneously often when they're trying to downplay the 10% dormant myth, if you used all of your brain all of the time, you couldn't have a brain scan because it all would be lit up uniformly. Isn't that true? So you've got to have areas of the brain that have less activity at one moment and more activity at another. You've got to have a modulation of brain activity for any type of brain scan to even work and show you that there is different levels of brain use at any given point in time. Also, what brain scans show us, that they only show us that there is some amount of activity relative to other parts of the brain which have lesser or greater parts of activity. It doesn't say that, let's say you take a cubic millimeter of brain tissue, which would contain thousands of neurons, a brain scan will only tell you that there is some amount of activity. It doesn't tell you how much is possible in that particular region of the brain. So the only conclusion, the only accurate conclusion that any reasonable scientist or medical person can come to is we don't know what the brain is capable of. We know that it can do certain things, but we also know that it can do incredible types of things that we didn't even know that the brain was possible to do. The brain has never said hard drive full. The only thing that you can say about the brain is that its potential is infinite. And I'm quoting a Nobel laureate, Sir John Eccles, when he said, the brain is limitless. And if the brain has infinite, limitless capability, then to say that you're using 10%, 90%, or any percentage has absolutely no meaning, because any percentage of infinity is an infinitely small percentage. So there is something to that saying that you use only 10% of your brain. What that means is we don't know how much the brain is capable of. It has infinite possibilities.
When you talk about tickling the amygdala, you're not talking about something physical. It's a mental tickle, isn't it?
I'm actually talking about something physical. It is an activity that you do with a mental processes, but mental processes are indeed physical processes. When you think about certain things, when you say, okay, I'm going to image something, I'm going to imagine something in my brain, you can see a physical change in blood flow and electrochemical activity within the brain. So thought is indeed a physical activity that you can trace through brain scanning. So when we say, when I tell a person to tickle their amygdala, or when a person tickles their amygdala, what they're forming is a mental process inside the limbic system that can actually be seen on a brain scan machine. And Dr. Herbert Benson and Sarah Lazar at Harvard Medical School actually did this. They did experiments that go back to, I believe it was 1999 was the beginning of these experiments, where they had people use their imagination, and then they saw the activity occur within, in this particular series of experiments by Benson and Lazar, in the limbic system and in the amygdala, just by thinking of it. So we're talking about real physical traceable activities. It's just not philosophy or some idea that some crazy person is thinking up. When you tickle your amygdala, you're actually causing a physical change within the human brain.
And isn't the amygdala the reptilian part of your brain?
No.
It's not.
The term the triune brain was started back in the 1960s, and it was adopted pretty quickly by brain researchers and medical people. It's not as widespread right now. And the triune brain refers to a model of the human brain that divides the brain up into three sections, what they call the reptilian brain, the mammal brain, and the primate brain. And more closely to medical terminology, the reptile brain is what's called the R complex. And Dr. Paul McLean invented this model of the brain. And the end of your spinal cord that comes up from your spine, or actually starts in the very innermost part of your brain and then goes down into your spine, that's called the reptile brain. And that part of your brain controls the most basic functions of human behavior. And it really allows us to exist on the same level as a reptile. There's no real thinking involved. It's all automatic. It controls your heart rate, your breathing, your fight or flight response, all those things that your brain does automatically. That's what is called the reptile brain, and it's in the center and it's the innermost part of your brain. Now, that's surrounded by another part of your brain that's called the limbic system, or Paul McLean called it the mammal brain. And what this part of your brain does is it adds on emotional content and basic social interactions. That's called the mammal brain. And then you've got this big wrinkly part. Whenever we see a picture of the human brain, we're actually looking at what's called the primate brain. And it's a further development of this mammal part of the brain. And it allows for much higher thinking, for imagination, for problem solving, for planning, for fine motor movement. And that's called the primate brain. So the amygdala is in the middle part of the brain. It's in the limbic system. And it receives signals from the reptile brain and from the mammal brain, from the primate brain. And what it does is it's a master click switch. So if your brain perceives threat, what it does, the amygdala then sends signals to the reptile brain and cranks up the reptile brain to go into high gear. So you can fight or flight if you
can. And react fast.
Yes, fast, without thinking. It's a gear shift.
Is it like if somebody cuts in front of you when you're driving, it's just instinctively you know what to do?
Yes, that's your amygdala coming into action.
Wow.
And you need that.
It clicks in then.
For self-preservation.
It really clicks in fast.
Yeah, if you're walking down a mountain trail and you see a snake, for example, you hop back and you either run or, you know, you might throw a rock at a snake, you know, to protect yourself, but it's automatic. But what is lesser known about the amygdala is it's also connected to the most advanced part of your brain. And when the amygdala is clicked forward as opposed to clicked backward, and we're using just kind of a coining a phrase here, you can click backward into your reptile brain. Your amygdala can click backward into your reptile brain and turn on fight or flight, but it can also click forward into the most advanced parts of your brain and to cooperation and loving behavior. And when it does that, you get reward. You feel pleasure and satisfaction. So the emotional part of this amygdala is when it clicks backward, you feel negative emotion because you feel threatened.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's clicked forward into the frontal lobes in the most advanced part of your brain, you feel pleasure. And it's nature's way of encouraging through positive emotions, more advanced behavior, and it discourages this reptilian behavior. It's a very clever design by nature to encourage you to use the most advanced, most cooperative, most creative parts of your brain. Because when you click your amygdala forward, or if you tickle your amygdala forward, you get these tremendous rewards and feelings of satisfaction. And life feels like it works right.
What part of your brain, Neil, kicks in your psychic abilities?
That is up to, you know, there's differing opinions on that. My feeling from my experience and the research that I've done is that a ordinary person, if they are able to consciously click their amygdala forward or tickle it forward into these cooperative frontal lobes, if they're able to turn on these creative parts of their brain, a further development is then into the psychic realms of precognition and telekinesis and things like that. So I believe that these advanced paranormal senses can voluntarily be elicited by concentrating on those processes that occur in the more advanced parts of our brain rather than, you know, in processes that might be a part of this reptilian or mammal brain.
Some people, Neil, have the ability to move objects, telekinesis.
Yes.
Now, are they doing that with the brain or is there something external that helps them?
You know, I think there's probably a variation in how physical objects are manipulated through mind control. I've had personal experiences myself that seem to be connected to conscious cooperative behaviors, more or less. Not because I was trying to make them happen, but because they were a side effect of engaging advanced types of thought processes.
Let me ask you this too. Has anybody ever, because the brain's like a storage facility, it's like a it's like a computer storing everything,
yes.
Storing memory and who you are and things you remember and recollect. Has anybody ever like woken up and they have no idea who they are? They have forgotten everything. The brain programming has been erased, basically.
It's been hacked.
It's been hacked.
Oh, I'm sure. You know, I'm sure that's, you know, what comes to mind for me, it has to do mostly with a injury, with a sudden traumatic injury, not so much from just waking up at random and losing information. I was riding a bicycle at one evening.
Hold on for one second, Neil. I'll have you tell us that story about the bicycle accident. And we're going to take phone calls in our final half hour with you next. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Neil Slade, our final segment with Neil. We'll take your calls. What I'd love for you to do is call in with some of your strange brain stories and how things have happened and affected you. Tell us about this bicycle accident, Neil.
Oh, well, you know, you had mentioned losing a memory or consciousness or whatever. I had just had an accident on my bicycle one evening. I ran into a road barrier that I hadn't seen, flipped onto my head. The next thing I knew, I had arrived back at my mother's house, which was about a mile away. I had no idea of how I got there. I couldn't remember my name. I couldn't even remember the accident. And it slowly came back to me about 10 minutes later as the amnesia wore off. And I've had similar experiences as the result of some drug experimentation. And so there's many ways that you can be disconnected from memory and even rational thought process. And I think what's important or interesting to note about those circumstances is that, at least in my case, there was something or somebody guiding me mm-hmm. outside of my own consciousness that allowed me to kind of safely remain alive and get to where I needed to go. And again, you know, that may be evidence of what we were talking about very earlier about, you know, where does consciousness actually reside? And there may be I know that historical figures talked about it, consciousness, a super consciousness that would look after one's well-being and state of being that existed, you know, far outside of one's own ego and immediate conscious control.
Neil, it is truly one of those magnificent things with the brain when you dream. Will we ever be able to download someone's dream and put it on like a flat screen and you could literally see it like a TV show?
You know, there's been some research recently, and I believe there's some Japanese researchers. They haven't been able to actually form, you know, pictures that we might see as movies in that detail and clarity. But there has been some research that is going in that direction to where there is some computer technology involved in reading of some brain waves that occur during sleep that can produce some type of imagery that's related to the content of our dream. I think what's probably more interesting and of more relevance is that an individual can interpret and use that dream content to one's benefit. And in terms of someone else reading or seeing the dream content, you know, I've had my own experience in the case of being very close to someone, in one case my wife, and I having the same shared dream content at one point. And so I think that's probably closer to the realm of something that we will be able to experience, only because the human brain is such a complex machine of such high potential. I think what we'll be able to do is read and see the dreams of other people probably long before
wow.
we can image dreams on mechanical devices.
And what is it about the brain, Neil, that is so functional and powerful? Because when you look at it, it's a globby mass of stuff.
Yes. Doesn't look like much.
And
it's,
no.
It's kind of like it's a very gushy, if you were to hold a brain in your hand, it's a very gushy kind of thing.
It's like wrapped up intestines.
Yeah,
it would
almost fall apart in your hands. But the brain is really the most complex structure that we know of in the universe. And I'm sure you've heard this on your show from other people, and I've mentioned it. Carl Sagan has been known to say that there are more possible neural connections in the average brain than there are literal stars in the known universe. There's more connections in your brain, and I'm speaking to anyone who's listening, than there are grains of sand on the planet. So the brain is just an infinity machine. And the work of T.D. Lingo and other brain researchers of his type was to see what was the brain capable of. If we were to remove all the social inhibitions, if we were to remove all the conventional ways of thinking and conventional education, what is possible with the human brain? And the answer that Lingo came up with after 35 years of research was that it's capable of anything you can think of. And that's a pretty powerful device. And that's why I found it so fascinating and why I've dedicated the last, oh, I guess it's been 35 and coming up to 40 years of my life helping people understand, you know, what the brain is about and how to get some brain self-control going.
All right, let's take some calls in the final 10 minutes we've got here left with you, Neil. Jim in Houston, Texas, welcome to the show. Hi, Jim.
Hey, I have a dream. It occurred a very long time ago, but it was really kind of interesting to me because in the dream, I was, of course, in high school. I'm 50 now. Just kind of an infatuation with a girl. But the very next day, I saw her, and then she smiled back at me. And it was almost as though that dream had occurred.
Oh.
Now, okay.
Precognitive dream content.
I'm sorry, sir?
You had a precognition in your dream. You saw something in your dream that occurred the next day.
Kind of, sort of, yeah, but it was almost like she smiled at me because I was a little shy because I thought, you know, I was just a guy dreaming.
Yeah.
And then she smiled back at me. And so I kind of recognized from there that I do experience some of these things. Okay. Thank you for answering my question because I've had a few more and you said it was towards the end and I want to let some people behind me.
There you go. Okay, you're very welcome.
Sleep is a very powerful time for people to engage brain self-control and engage and come into touch with these paranormal types of abilities. And the reason for that is because when you're sleeping, you click out of that reptilian defense mode. You're in bed and you feel safe, and instead of feeling as though you have to protect yourself, you relax. And when you relax, you make yourself available to these more advanced, cooperative types of thought processes. And out of those arise the precognitive and creative abilities that surface during dreaming and during sleep.
Neil, when people get exhausted, what is it that's gets tired? Is it the brain, or is it? I mean,
oh, you mean why do we need to sleep?
Yeah, I mean, because it's really, when you think of it, one of the strangest things out there. Why do you shut down? I'm beginning to think it's the brain. I mean, the physical body rests, but I don't think it needs as much sleep as the brain does.
Yeah, well, the brain remains very active during sleep, but it goes through different kinds of activities. And scientists believe that one of the things, of course, one of the things it does is it rids itself of certain types of chemicals and processes that are created while you're awake and engaged in normal activity. People don't know exactly what goes on. Again, we just know the tip of the iceberg. But we do know that sleep deprivation leads very, very quickly to a lot of reduction in normal brain function and cognition.
Yes.
So you definitely need that sleep just to perform on an ordinary level.
I think it's for the brain, though, sleep.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, both the brain and the body need that, and probably the brain needs that rest and the sleep more than the body does.
I think you're right, absolutely. International line, we're going to Ontario, Canada. Hello, John.
Hello, George.
Hello there.
And to your guests.
Hi there.
Hello. I have had two cases of full-blown Another word just escaped my mind.
Memory lapse. That's what you were going to say. Memory lapse.
No, well, I have that. But the other that you were just talking about, not the brain.
I'll tell you what, John. Get your thoughts. I'll come back to you. Make sure you know what you're going to do. Yeah. Write them down just so you're ready. Let's go next to Helen in Payson, Arizona. Welcome to the show. Hi, Helen.
Thank you so much for letting me speak with you and your guest tonight.
You're welcome.
I'm calling from Arizona, and I'm an abductee, but also a person in the sciences and medical. And I asked the ET and some other benevolent groups of higher dimensions about shared manifested consciousness. And I had a question about that. Now, I've been told it's possible that if humanity starts to, basically kind of balance their ego into more of, instead of just service to yourself, service to others, and connect with the planet, ultimate creator, and Mother Earth, then we could basically share our consciousness and start creating a new reality, because right now our planet is on the brink. And it's really critical. Like, we have a lot of pollution and some really poor leadership right now, as we know. How can we, and is it possible, to actually share this manifestation right now as a group? And if so, how would we go about doing this? I'm already trying to do it, and there's large numbers of us who are being synchronistically moved to run into one another, you know, so to speak. Not literally, but, you know, not with a car. But
so you're talking about synchronizing your brain. Can that be done?
Oh, absolutely. We've proven that on Coast to Coast, haven't we? Probably many times. Originally we did the brain focus experiment, where we had all of the listeners focus on creating rain in Florida during a terrible drought. And we watched the satellite pictures of the rain come in, and at that point, that day, we asked for 10 inches of rain, because that's what they said would put out the fires in northern Florida. And sure enough, in our coast-to-coast experiment, we did that as a group. And I think the place for everyone to start is individually. And my work and T.D. Lingo's work at the Brain Lab has been really focused on teaching people to recognize the difference between their reptilian behaviors, which is the me, selfish, I'm the only one who matters type of consciousness, and recognize that, and then recognize how it differs from the advanced cooperative consciousness, in which we realize that we're all on this planet together. And the way to advance civilization is through cooperation, as opposed to a warring state of mind. So I think the place really for any person is to start with their own brain and make themselves a more cooperative individual concerned with life outside of the limits of one's own skin. And by doing that, and easily recognizing how your brain shifts from reptile brain to advanced brain, within an instant, if you can gain control of that and understanding of that as an individual, then that will spread like a good virus, as it were. And you can teach your friends and share with your friends, and we'll have a mass movement of a brain revolution, as it were, where we're not just thinking about ourselves, but we're thinking about others and the planet as a whole.
Brain power, Neil, is
brain power. That's where it's at. That's why I pursue that. And what's nice about when you study about the human brain is that you understand behavior, and you understand your relationship with the planet, with other people. And it doesn't matter what religion you are, it doesn't matter what politics are, because beyond politics and religion and skin color and sex and all of that stuff, We all have a human brain, and the brain in each individual is relatively works the same way in each one of us. And what turns on, the things that are rewarding to individuals are something that we share with all other individuals.
And it's amazing, though, Neil, that how some parts of the brain, there could be some abnormality creating a serial killer or
yes.
somebody like that.
Well, we actually know what part of the brain that occurs in. That's in the medial prefrontal cortex. There's a little groove that runs down the middle of your brain.
Is it damaged in a serial killer?
It is damaged, or it's damaged, or it's inactive, and they've done research about that. So they know that when this part of the brain is responsible for putting yourself in somebody else's shoes, having the perspective of what it's like to be in someone else's situation, or empathy. That's the part of the brain that's responsible for empathy. If that part of the brain is inactive or damaged, then you will end up with a criminal that has no remorse, or you end up with a serial killer, or someone who doesn't have any responsibility for his actions and doesn't feel as though he's responsible for his actions. So we actually know that part of the brain that is responsible for that.
That's amazing. Have they done that in studies?
Yeah, I can't give you details. It's sort of on the tip of my tongue. This was a study that was done in a penitentiary, and they did brain scans of psychotic criminals versus a normal criminal. A type of criminal that had no remorse, that didn't know the difference between right and wrong, and another type of criminal who did know the difference between right and wrong and what it would be like to be the victim in a crime.
And they scanned.
And they were
brains?
Able to see what part of the brain
was
different in these two different prison populations.
That is great information, Neil. It really is. Neil's website, of course, it's his name, neilslade.com, N-E-I-L, slade.com, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, we're going to come back with Open Lines on Coast to Coast AM.